coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
After I've done all the screening, I talk to them about their lifestyle. I talk to them about how does ketamine work in the body? And really one of the main ways that I describe ketamine, I mean, it works in multiple ways. It works on many different neurotransmitter systems, but it actually acts as an agent of increasing neuroplasticity. And it also is an NMDA receptor antagonist. So it actually can reduce glutamate excitotoxicity. So it's really interesting medicine for sure. Like a very interesting drug. It's got so many different mechanisms of action. So after I do a little bit of a science education of like, this is how it's going to work in your brain. It's going to help your brain form new connections. And then it's going to help you basically think your way and work your way out of this ditch that you're in. So it's going to help you problem solve. And so we talk about set and setting. We talk about preparation. So I talk to them about reducing sugar. I talk to them about reducing excess processed foods. I talk to them about getting enough steps. I talk to them about working out. I talk to them about sleep. I talk to them about meditation. So I'm really trying to prepare their lifestyle to encourage the healing process.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Today on the podcast, I'm speaking to Dr. Molly Maloof, a concierge and lifestyle medicine practitioner who has developed a comprehensive protocol for ketamine-assisted therapy. On the show, we talk about Molly's professional journey from burning out in residency to concierge medicine to Stanford professor and ketamine practitioner. We discuss her protocol in detail and why one shouldn't try to treat their own depression with street ketamine. Finally, Dr. Molly gives her advice to new practitioners, especially regarding creating a brand in the psychedelic space. Dr. Molly is a physician, an entrepreneur, a medical advisor, a ketamine practitioner, and a Stanford lecturer. She has advised over 42 companies throughout the world and lectured extensively. You can catch her on the Psychedelic News Hour on Fridays on Clubhouse or in the App Store as a podcast in January. Healing is holistic, and it seems like Dr. Molly has thought of everything. Dr. Molly Maloof, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It is such an honor to have you on the show. I've wanted to have you on the show since we started. For the listener, Molly and I have been friends for a long time, and it's just been such a pleasure to watch you blossom in this space and to share your wisdom with so many people, and really to see you just emerge as one of the leaders of the psychedelic renaissance. What a wonderful way your life has unfolded, Molly. It's so cool.
It's so interesting that it's happened. And I have to admit, when, you know, you and I really started becoming friends many years ago, you were like, Molly, you have to be Dr. Molly. This has to be your brand. And I was like, I don't know if I can run with that. But you know what? The truth is that it was so on point. You had nailed it. And yeah, you know, like it's taken a lot of, frankly, courage. And I have to admit that like I was certainly very scared to get involved with psychedelics publicly. Years ago, I remember when I had an interview by the Financial Times and they took my photograph and they were putting me in their, you know, in the publication. I was like, oh shit, I am definitely coming out of the psychedelic closet publicly right now. Hopefully I don't get into too much trouble. And you know what? Nothing happened. I mean, nothing serious happened. I didn't get my license taken away. I didn't get reprimanded. I was mostly just talking about how people were using psychedelics for optimizing their performance in Silicon Valley. And I thought it was really interesting. And it's so funny because since then, I actually found an article written by a Marine all about how this Marine thinks that the government should let armed services, special forces, and Marines use microdosing in order to enhance their performance. So it's like, it's really becoming pretty commonplace now to talk about psychedelics publicly. And I just feel really grateful that I got to be kind of a part of the beginning of this sort of renaissance, I guess. But things have changed a lot since we, you know, first started working together as and meeting each other and knowing each other professionally and personally. You know, there's been a lot of movement in the pharmacology space. There's been a bunch of IPOs this year with big companies. There's been a huge wave of ketamine-assisted therapy. MAPS has made massive strides in getting MDMA-assisted therapy approved as a breakthrough medication for PTSD. Psilocybin's been approved as a breakthrough medication for depression. But like, these are still under research protocols right now. These are still not available for widespread use. So we still have a long way to go, but we're way further along than we were when you and I first started talking about this stuff. So it's pretty exciting to be in kind of in the thick of it right now. You know, I myself have actually started adopting psychedelic medicine in my practice. And so to talk a little bit about how I've gone more publicly with it this summer, Dr. Dave Rabin, who's an amazing ketamine-assisted psychotherapist and entrepreneur, and one of my just dear friends, he came and visited me in Illinois with his wife, Catherine, who's his co-founder of his company, Apollo Neuro. And we were sitting around having dinner, and he was like, you know, we were both of us, I was telling him about this app called Clubhouse. And basically I said, you know, we should just start a psychedelics club and like start talking about this on this app. Cause like this app is where all the tech people are, and all the tech people kind of dispersed from San Francisco, including you, including me. We've all kind of spread out, but we've all been congregating on this app. So Dave Rabin and I were like, we should start a little club and we should start a podcast. And we should just see what happens. And it's kind of turned into this like weekly thing we do, and we're about to release it on iTunes. So it's like pretty exciting stuff to be doing this right now in this year, given how much is going on in the world.
Well, and you pointed out that when you first decided to publicly speak about psychedelics, that there was a lot of fear about that. And so I think that a lot of people listening who are listening to this very program, because they are mental health practitioners, they are doctors themselves, and they're like, oh, is this something that I should explore? That tide has really turned.
Yeah.
But you were, you know, very courageously coming out earlier. I think it'd be helpful for the audience to locate you, and they may not be familiar with you and your work, to talk a bit about where you were as a doctor prior to bringing psychedelics into your practice, prior to being a public spokesperson in the way that you've become on Clubhouse and in, you know, publications. Let's talk about before there even was Dr. Molly.
Yeah.
Let's talk, you were doing concierge medicine. Is that the right expression?
And I am still doing concierge medicine. I still have a small panel of patients that I work with really intensely. It's like, the only way to describe it is it's like bespoke medicine. If you were to go get a custom car or a custom suit made or custom anything that's completely handmade, that's what my practice has basically been that. And since I've had a bunch of experiences in the last few years, I'm actually in the process of really transforming my career into more of a public-facing educator and less of a just private doctor, because I get so many requests from people who want to know what I do. I guess maybe what we could do is, before I talk about my practice and how I use psychedelics in my practice, maybe we'll go back to like my sort of experience with psychedelics from the very beginning. So I grew up in Illinois. I went to medical school in Illinois. I went to college in Illinois. And I was really curious about consciousness from a young age. I grew up very religious, but I kind of like moved away from religion and really still found myself spiritual, but curious and you know, kind of like a explorer in a way. And I was a voracious reader. So I was in college and I was in the history and philosophy library. And I remember finding this section on the history of drugs. And I was like, whoa, there's like an entire small section of like, of just books on like the history of drugs. And I was like, I'm going to learn the entire history of all drugs. So I would take these books, and because I worked at the library, I could check books out for months at a time and just like keep a little mini library in my room. And I was reading all of these books on, you know, I was interested in like, why did humans want to alter their minds? And I hadn't even taken drugs. And I was just curious. I was like, I mean, the only thing I had done at that time was drink and maybe smoked a joint here and there. And so I just really wasn't wasn't actively engaged in the consumption of any psychedelics or any drugs. I was just curious. And so I would read all these books and I was just like, whoa, like humans have been doing this since the beginning of time. Like since we can even remember the history, the drugs in humanity have been a huge, they've co-evolved. Right. And so I was like, wow, why are these so taboo, you know, given that they're so pervasive in human culture throughout the world? And I just thought it was really fascinating. And so I'd read so much about them. And then I actually went to a music festival in the middle of Indiana. It was in between college and medical school. And I had a summer off and I went and I tried psychedelics for the first time. I tried mushrooms. And I remember being, first of all, being like, I really shouldn't be doing this at a festival. There's way too many people here that I don't know. And I was very, there was a point where I got very paranoid and very scared because I was like, what if somebody knows I'm high and I'm going to get in trouble. And I didn't want to get arrested. So I went back to my tent and my camp and I just basically stayed in my camp for like the rest of the day. And I remember laying down, staring at trees and just being like, holy crap, this is the most profound experience of my life. And I remember seeing my friend who had gone there with dancing in a field. And I was like, okay, he's good. I'm good. We're safe. And the next day I was in such awe. Like the only way to describe my experience was I was in such awe of my reality that I was totally speechless. And as like a talker and very much a communicator and like somebody who's constantly talking, to be speechless and like, so in awe of what I had experienced, I was like, this is profound. And I actually didn't even touch mushrooms for many years after that experience because it was so life-changing. I was like, I don't actually need to do this again. Like I didn't really feel the desire to like regularly use these. Plus I was on a path to go to medical school and to go and, you know, there was no way I was going to compromise that path. So I get to med school. I'm basically the least fun person you can ever meet. I did nothing but study for 4 years and did nothing but work and did nothing but, I mean, about halfway through, I was like pretty burned out and I transformed my lifestyle through a bunch of different things and really got really obsessed with health and lifestyle medicine and even designed a course about it for my peers because I had done dramatically better on my tests and my board exams after I had improved my lifestyle. And everybody was like, whoa, so you just like rocked your board exam and you changed your lifestyle. And so I ended up being like kind of moving all my interests into lifestyle medicine. And so went to residency, found myself really unhappy in my residency, and then decided to leave my residency. And that was actually a decision made largely because I had a psychedelic experience that enabled me to have what's called ego death. I had turned to psychedelics in a moment of deep depression. And frankly, I was in a lot of despair. I was like, you know, I just finished my intern year of my residency. I was really unhappy. I didn't like the person I was becoming. I didn't like the system I was working in. I didn't like the fact that there was just so many reasons why what was called a healthcare system was actually a sickness billing industrial complex that was largely, you know, billing and coding for disease. And it wasn't, you know, doctors weren't getting paid for improving health. They were getting paid to fix broken bodies and then get people out the door. And so I really just felt very, very unhappy. And I was like, well, look, I'm either going to leave my residency or I'm going to stick with it, but I need to decide what I'm going to do here. And by the way, I would never recommend people do this. I was definitely like the thing you need to know about psychedelics is that you really should never change your life dramatically after you take psychedelics. You're really supposed to give yourself a month of integration, but I was a novice. I was an amateur at the time. I mean, I wouldn't say an amateur, but I was definitely like, it was definitely a point where like I was experimenting and this was way before there was any education for anyone on psychedelics properly integrate. So I had a psychedelic experience, and in that experience, I felt my entire life, and from the beginning to the end, and I was like, oh my God, I'm living my life living my life to please other people, and to please society and to please the systems and the bureaucracies, and to be someone that I wasn't. And the truth is that the medicine I took really taught me that it was time for me to actually, you know, grab the reins of my existence and actually decide the direction I was going to take it. And it was a really terrifying experience it was a beautiful experience, but it was also like, I left that experience being like, there's no way I'm going back into that system. I have to get out of this world that I'm in. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. So at that time, everyone was like, why are you leaving your residency? What is wrong with you? And I didn't tell them about my psychedelic experience. I said, I'm leaving my residency because I don't like the model that it's using right now. I don't think this model is working the way that I want to work. And I want to build a new model of medicine. And they're like, good luck. So I thought to myself, what if you built a practice that helped optimize health instead of just fix sickness? What if it was about building health? Like, that was just the first premise of the practice. And then I was able to meet doctors and I was able to get this work from this company, MediMed, that really taught me this really rigorous way of thinking about science, thinking about reason, thinking about logic. And then from working with other doctors, I learned about how do you build expert systems? How do you build AI systems for optimizing health? How do you use technology to improve health? And in the process of trying to fund my practice, because I didn't have any funding to build a medical practice and I wasn't taking any more loans out, I actually worked for over, in the last 10 years, I've worked for over 45 tech companies as an advisor, as a consultant. And I was basically using the chief medical officer for hire model, where companies would come in and say, we need a chief medical officer. We need to figure out how to do this thing. We need to work with the healthcare system. We need to create this system. We don't know how to do it. Help us understand. And so I got basically to create my own life. I got to create this new existence. I got to create a practice that really took health, technology, and wellness and married them all. But the problem was, as about a few years ago, I discovered that there was something really missing from my practice. I was really focused on the body. I was focused on the physiology. I was focused on the anatomy. I was focused on the physical structure, but I had totally forgotten about psychology and spirituality. And I had actually put spirituality on a shelf for like 10 years because I didn't know what I believed. And I really didn't have a strong spiritual practice because I didn't know what to believe after I left my religion like 20 years ago, or like maybe I guess 15 years ago. So I didn't have a spiritual practice. And then the people that I had been working with in Silicon Valley were largely what are called rationalists. They were people who were dedicated to eliminating all emotional interference from reason. And I discovered through hanging out with a lot of hippies that when I hung out with my hippie friends, I felt better. I felt like heart-oriented. I felt heart-focused. And when I hung out with all my scientist friends, I felt kind of closed off. I felt a little bit heady and intellectual. And I felt really kind of stuck in that sort of intellectual framework and cognitive world. And I got to this moment where I was like, wow, I'm really successful, but I'm not happy. And I'm like looking at my practice. I'm like, well, crap, like what's missing from this picture? I've got the science, I've got the health, I've got the biology, but like, where's the spirituality? Where's the mental health? Like, where's the psychology in all of this, you know? And so I started hanging out with my hippie friends. And so I started doing a lot more sort of woo-woo personal development stuff that you'd see people do in California, stuff that I would like have never have thought I would get myself into. But it was because I was like, I'm not happy. I need to figure out a way to become happier. And it's like, I'm not going to go take psychiatric medicines. I wasn't depressed. I wasn't fully flourishing. And I'd reached a lot of success. And I was just like, whoa, like there's something wrong here when like all of my clients who are hyper successful are miserable. They have more money than they could ever need. And they're not happy. They're never satisfied with what they have. And this is like a huge problem in Silicon Valley. And I was looking around, I'm like, does anyone else realize that Silicon Valley is miserable? Like, and we're building the future and this might be a problem, because if this is a preview for what the future looks like, we have got an issue here. So I started exploring more of the spiritual realm, the magical realm, the realm of, you know, the stuff that, you know, wouldn't have really fit within any textbook in medical school. And I started slowly waking up. And I guess during this time of waking up, I guess I was starting to talk about psychedelics a bit in the public. And I was like, there's a lot of microdosing going on in Silicon Valley. I think people are kind of turning to something. There's also a lot of biohacking going on. So I think I was kind of like, wow, there's a lot of biohacking. There's a lot of microdosing. Something's going on. And if there's one thing you need to know about Silicon Valley, it's that there's always this undercurrent of innovation happening before it's above ground. And so I was like, wow, like there's a lot of undercurrent of psychedelic medicine happening and it's not responsible. And I was kind of like lecturing a lot of people. I was like, you know, there's gotta be a better way for people to be doing this than experimenting with their bodies, because this doesn't seem safe. And so I started looking into MAPS, and I actually worked with MAPS at one of the conferences as a psychedelic emergency responder. And I basically started researching again. And I was like, okay, so I know that psychedelics are going to become medicine within the next 5 to 10 years. And so there's going to have to be a way for me to do this now that's legal and safe and careful, that isn't going to get me my license taken away, that's going to be something that's above ground. And so I started using ketamine-assisted therapy in my practice. And I started reading, you know, Phil Wolfson's book, The Ketamine Papers. I started designing my own protocol. I started talking to compounding pharmacies. And I started testing it on a small number of clients who were willing to try the medicine and the protocol. And I was discovering that when you combined ketamine-assisted therapy with psychotherapy, which I had some great psychotherapists that I was working with and I still am working with, I was seeing people really transform and being able to pull themselves out of depression in a pretty quick turnaround. And I was like, whoa, this is game changing. So it's now 2020. Everything became telemedicine about a year ago. And I was actually doing telemedicine in November of last year because I had moved to Maui for a 3-month sabbatical to work on a book proposal. And so I started doing telemedicine and realized like, oh, like I can work remotely anywhere. And so this year, last year, and has really been refining this protocol and working with people remotely and trying to really help keep people alive, because I know a few people who've committed suicide this year who I didn't know were depressed. And so I really see the next few years, a huge role in our collective healing is going to be ketamine, MDMA, and psilocybin assisted therapy through physician offices and licensed psychotherapists in order to help people properly integrate and be properly prepared for their experience and to have reliable experiences that aren't going to damage their health or their life. And so I've decided to really take my practice and instead of just helping the elite, develop a protocol that's going to help a lot more people than the people that I've been taking care of. So it's been a really crazy ride, but I had a really great mentor who said to me, Molly, if you practice in a way that always, always makes your patients feel like you really deeply care about them, then you will have a flourishing career and you will have a flourishing practice and you'll be able to take these risks and you won't have to worry as much about, you know, getting in trouble for being on the forefront of a lot of stuff. So that's me today. And so far it's been a really beautiful experience to be alive and to be able to help people as a physician in this way.
Wow, Molly, what a journey you've been on to get to the place you are now. And there's been a lot of courageous moves forward. And I appreciate you outlining so clearly kind of how you made those decisions. A moment ago, you were talking about how you started as a concierge medical doctor, and you were really focusing on physiology, you're really focusing on the body. And you realized through your own experiences that there were elements of psychology and especially spirituality that were missing in the holistic healing of a person. And that's part of how you incorporated psychedelic medicine into your work. And I'd like to zero in on that a little bit mm-hmm. in this moment, because I would imagine as, you know, as a medical doctor, the way that you were trained, what you went to school for, it wasn't necessarily incorporating these spiritual aspects. So I'm curious what you've learned in your own process of incorporating spirituality into medicine that might be helpful for other practitioners.
Yeah. Well, I definitely had, you know, experienced psychedelics at events like Burning Man, but I hadn't really recognized that. In fact, what a lot of people don't realize that doctors offer people is a sense of hope and a sense of, and being able to help them, shepherd them through the existential moments of our life, which is when we have to face our life or our death. And that is where spirituality really comes into play with medicine. The way that I have seen it evolve through psychedelic assisted therapy is right now, the modern medicine model is about treating pathology. And so psychedelics are a natural fit for diseases of despair and deaths of despair, preventing the deaths of despair. So a lot of the violence, the self-violence, the addiction, the suicidality, the depression, the anxiety, the end of life, you know, despair, the PTSD, all of these things have a component of people being so stuck and being so in a moment of terror and fear of, I don't either want to live or the life that I'm living makes no sense anymore. And so I need some sort of answer. And when people turn to addictions, they're turning to the addictions because they don't know what else to do, because they don't know how else to not feel the pain that they're feeling which is so deep and so awful that they just want to feel like it. They just want to feel, you know, some relief. And so when I was watching the streets of San Francisco be covered in people who are literally in despair, I realized something in my own life had to change, because I was like, there's got to be a solution. Like, our society is sick, is really, really sick. And so I went to Maui, and I basically went to like the place in America I consider to be one of the most spiritual places in the world and in our country. And I basically let Maui kind of hold me and help me rediscover who I was. And I think a lot of what psychedelics can help people do through the spiritual component is actually rediscover, what is the real meaning of your life? What is the purpose of your existence? Why do you need to like get out of bed in the morning to keep living? And what they can do for people is, if you have a particularly profound psychedelic experience, what you will have is a mystical experience. And whether you believe in God or not, I believe that mystical experiences are profoundly useful for healing, specifically because so much of what's wrong with our existence is the sensation that we are separate selves, the sensation that we are somehow alone in our suffering. And what psychedelics do for people is they unlock the doors that connect you to all things, that connect you to the entire fabric of the universe, and make you realize that this isn't all about you. You are nothing but you. Well, first of all, we are nothing and everything. And in that, we become free of the shackles of our ego that make us seem like we're living a delusion of this separate consciousness. And so that's where I think it's actually really important that we make sure that the psychedelic renaissance properly changes things for people and doesn't become just come into the clinic, get your fix and go. Because that is not healing. That is not how people heal. That is actually just making people numb again. And we don't want people to turn to psychedelics for escape and for numbing. We want them to actually be properly prepared. We want people to be asking themselves the right questions going into the experience. Like, what am I trying to bring into my life? What am I trying to like let go of in my life? And what are some things that I need to question and work through? And one of the things that I do with certain entrepreneurs who are particularly, some of my entrepreneurs that I work with are atheists or not necessarily spiritual people. And I tell them the interesting thing about psychedelic experiences and meditation and the state that you can get into through even dream work. I actually consider dream work to be a kind of a third space of gnosis. So gnosis is G-N-O-S-I-S. And these Gnostic states, these states of kind of like you're loosening your conscious grip on reality and you're kind of letting the subconscious in. When you're in that state, you can actually be more creative. You can actually manifest more effectively. You can actually vision more effectively. This is a state where you can kind of let your consciousness flow and start thinking about things. And I'll be completely honest with you. I know for a fact that there are some of the biggest names in technology, in entrepreneurship, in architecture, in multiple industries, some of the biggest names of these industries, they use psychedelics in order to create. Steve Jobs was public about his psychedelic use. Elon Musk has been public about his psychedelic use. So I think that there's also a way to sort of encourage people to consider the possibility of a future where psychedelics can be used for problem solving, some of our greatest problems. And in fact, the government has actually used psychedelics for research and development for a long time. So I believe that we're going to see a medicinal case of psychedelics. And then there will also potentially be a sort of a visionary use of psychedelics, specifically for problem solving some of the greatest problems of humanity. And I think the spiritual realm is this realm of, you know, being able to let go of our ego and be able to like enter the sense of connectedness, the sense of being part of this, kind of like tapping into this field of infinite intelligence and beauty. And that's the way I describe it to people. And I hope that makes sense to people who are listening.
Molly, I'd like to know exactly how you use psychedelics in your practice today, because I think a lot of the people listening will be exploring ketamine-assisted therapy for the first time. They may be students at, say, CIIS, and looking at someone like yourself who's built a really successful personal brand as a concierge medical doctor and is now incorporating psychedelic therapy. I'm curious, how do you go about the ketamine-assisted therapy that you offer to your patients?
So the first thing I do is I kind of send everybody ahead of time, what is this ketamine-assisted therapy protocol? So I send them a bunch of paperwork, basically. I have essentially a 20-page protocol, and then I have a large number of questionnaires that I give people. And the questionnaires are designed to screen for mental health problems, so I know the diagnosis that they've got. I've also used questionnaires to identify their health status. I have a questionnaire that's a holistic health questionnaire, and it basically helps me understand where in their life are they healthier or not healthier. So I can screen their physical health, I can screen their psychological health and their spiritual health. And I actually got that questionnaire from, I modified a questionnaire from another doctor's book that I read. And then I have a bunch of my own questionnaires.
What is that book?
The book is called The Sinus Survival, I believe. And it's a holistic health book about sinus health. And this doctor has a great questionnaire that's all about, you know, the mind, body, and spirit. And I've actually tried to contact him. I haven't been able to get a hold of him, but he's a brilliant doctor. And it's a great book if anyone suffers from sinus troubles. I see a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of people who suffer from chronic sinus conditions. So I've taken that questionnaire, I've modified it for my own use. And then I have, you know, the mental health screening questionnaires. And then I have just like physical health screening questionnaires. So I want to see if there's anything physical that could be causing their condition. So I'm looking for things like hypothyroid symptoms. I'm looking for things like hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis dysfunction. You know, how much stress are they under? I have a bunch of stress questionnaires that I give people because really I believe that chronic stress will break the brain. And so what happens under chronic stress is that you actually have declines in neuroplasticity. And so when a person's neuroplasticity starts to go down and they really kind of get stuck in a rut, and it's kind of like you're in a ditch. And you're like in this ditch and you can't crawl out of the ditch because you actually can't think of the solution to get out of the ditch. And anybody who's ever been depressed knows that there's some memory deficits. And a lot of it is just your brain is kind of in a self-preservation mode. So what I have done with the screening system is identify who should and should not get ketamine. Do you have any specific predispositions that would be problematic for you to receive this medicine? So I basically screen out all the reasons why you shouldn't take the medicine. And then I screen for all the reasons why you would be a candidate for the medicine. And then I look at the person's overall health status. And that gives me something to talk to them about when I have the first meeting with them. And then in that first meeting, I also, after reviewing their questionnaires with them and their problems and getting an idea of who they are and what their life is about, I also go through the protocol. And so I explain to them, okay, so here's the reasons why you're a candidate. Here's the reasons why you are not excluded. So I really actually double check to make sure that they don't have any of the conditions that would be problematic for people. So like borderline personality disorder, schizoaffective disorder, schizophrenia, any history of psychosis, seizure disorder, uncontrolled hypertension, and there's a few others basically that you want to make sure people don't have if they're going to use ketamine-assisted therapy.
Molly, is there a resource for people who are interested to look at all those contraindications? I understand that within the medical community, practitioners will know those, but are there any resources that people can go online
Definitely.
To look at that?
I mean, the best book on ketamine that has ever been written is called Ketamine Papers. And it's a phenomenal book. It's a collection of medical literature. And it's been written by Phil Wolfson, who's basically the godfather of ketamine-assisted therapy. So I highly recommend any doctor, any interested person. I mean, it's very medical and very technical, but I'm about to produce, you know, a bunch of like consumer-oriented content around ketamine anyway. I'm building an online course on the topic. You can also go to Third Wave. I'm sure they have some stuff on ketamine on their website. So after I read that book and after I, you know, did my diligence on ketamine-assisted therapy, I realized that there was really two main therapeutic modalities of ketamine that were the safest for individual use outside of a medical clinic. And that's intranasal ketamine and sublingual ketamine. Now, a lot of what people are doing is they're going to ketamine clinics or pain clinics, and they're getting the screening of the conditions that it can be treated for, but they're not getting the integration piece, right? So the ketamine protocol that I work with people on is all about preparation, administration, and integration. And so after I've done all the screening, I talk to them about their lifestyle. I talk to them about how does ketamine work in the body? And really one of the main ways that I describe ketamine, I mean, it works in multiple ways. It works on many different neurotransmitter systems, but it actually acts as an agent of increasing neuroplasticity. And it also is an NMDA receptor antagonist. So it actually can reduce glutamate excitotoxicity. So it's really interesting medicine for sure, like a very interesting drug. It's got so many different mechanisms of action. So after I do a little bit of a science education of like, this is how it's going to work in your brain. It's going to help your brain more form new connections. And then it's going to help you basically think your way and work your way out of this ditch that you're in. So it's going to help you problem solve. And so we talk about set and setting, we talk about preparation. So one of the things that I recognized is that for people who are undergoing ayahuasca, there's always this diet that they recommend. And so what I decided to do was kind of make a modified ayahuasca diet that was really about cleaning up the diet, moving out all of the things that were toxic, like bringing in all the things that are nutritious, and making sure to make sure that when I talk to the person, I screen them for what their diet is and their lifestyle is like. So I want to make sure that they're doing at least 14 hours of fasting so that they're getting some of the cleansing components of fasting. 14 hours of fasting is not going to hurt anybody for the most part. And I talk to them about reducing sugar. I talk to them about reducing excess processed foods. I talk to them about getting enough steps. I talk to them about working out. I talk to them about sleep. I talk to them about meditation. So I'm really trying to prepare their lifestyle to encourage the healing process. And my clients who have worked with me and have incorporated the lifestyle component, they definitely say that the lifestyle changes really do aid in the healing process. So I talk about some things that you can use alongside ketamine to improve the experience. I'm actually a big fan of CBD because its effects on neuroplasticity. And so I recommend a little bit of CBD. I recommend a variety of other things. And then I talk to them about preparation. So we talk about how do you create intention? What is intention setting about, right? Intention is literally about, let's say you have a vision for what your life to be. Intention is like directing the experience of your psychedelic medicine, session towards that vision. It's like, I'm going to try to create some goals for my life that I'm going to use my psychedelic experiences as intention. I'm going to use the intention setting to sort of direct my life towards those goals. And maybe the goal is to recover from depression. Maybe the goal is to find a new job. Maybe the goal is to let go of a relationship that was no longer serving you. But it's really about creating the right internal setting and then creating the right external setting. So making sure that people have the right setup in their room. So because I don't have a physical clinic right now because of COVID, I'm prescribing people to use ketamine for home use. And so the max I prescribe is once a week. Or actually once to max twice a week. Twice a week is for people who I do intensive supervision with to make sure these are for people who are either actively suicidal or have been suicidal in the past and they just need more monitoring. But most of the time, once a week is really the safest and probably the most effective. And some people only use it every other week or some people even once a month. So it doesn't have to be a very high intensity medication like daily use of SSRIs. And so, and the truth is that I want people to basically set up their session so that they use it on a weekend and they don't end up having a lot to do the next day, because really what you want to do is have this time for integration. So you set the intention, you talk about how to create the safe surrounding at home. So I have a huge, huge talk on safety and making sure that you do not have any, like there's a bunch of risks. The biggest risk is falls. And so I hammer into each client, we want to make your home as safe as possible for this medicine. Otherwise, we're not using it. And then from there, we talk about, what kind of music you listen to during the session and how do you set up your bed as a nest and how do you use blind, you put an eye mask over your eyes. And then when the session is over, there's aftercare recommendations. And then I have an entire section on integration, on different methods for integration. And so what I tell people is I want you to spend the next day to actually work on yourself. I want you to work. I want you to give yourself the space to draw, to paint, to read, to answer. I have a bunch of questions that I give people to ask themselves. I have people work with psychotherapists to make sure that they work through the things that have come up. So occasionally what will happen is in a psychedelic medicine experience, some people who aren't prepared properly Or maybe they think they're prepared and they sound like they're prepared, but then they have their first psychedelic experience and it digs up a bunch of stuff that's been shoved under the rug for many, many years. And it can actually be a very, very emotional experience. They have to make sure that I actually help tell people to stop the protocol. And I want them to go directly into more intensive therapy, because there's a certain amount of work that you need to do to even really begin this medicine. And if you're not careful and you go straight into ketamine assisted therapy without the preparation and without sort of mental framework preparation, then it can dig up a bunch of things and a bunch of trauma. And you got to make sure that you are going to be able to integrate and to work through and not run away from the things that you've been, the things that have basically been buried in your consciousness because you have not wanted to look at them, because trauma, nobody wants to look at your trauma, because if you did, I mean, like if our brains wanted to look at a trauma, we wouldn't bury it, right? So when you bring up traumatic things for people, you got to make sure to, they really need to be, they need to be in the hands of somebody who can work with them on a psychotherapy framework. So that's why I work with psychotherapists. And I found that not everybody needs ketamine. It's not a panacea. It doesn't fix every problem. But when people are ready for it and when people are properly prepared for it, it can be really helpful for helping people heal from existential problems, depression, and PTSD.
Something that's been coming up a lot with the value of ketamine for depression is that people are using ketamine recreationally in the interest of helping their depression. Now, why might that be a problem for people? Why do people need this full protocol? Now, I know you've talked about the integration, that sort of thing. But if someone's suffering from depression, they have no outlet, maybe they can buy some ketamine on the street and they could take it on their own. Why is that not something you'd advise?
Okay, the first reason is this ketamine on the street is usually cut with fillers. And one of the things that is pretty prominent in the literature is that people who are regular users of street ketamine often have bladder damage. And that's because of all of these, you know, ingredients in ketamine that aren't ketamine. And so regular habitual use of street ketamine can lead to bladder dysfunction and bladder damage and potentially permanent bladder, you know, problems. And so if you really want to keep your organs functioning properly, you really shouldn't be buying drugs on the street, because unfortunately they're just not clean. And dirty drugs is unfortunately going to be a dirty experience. I also kind of believe that the medicine that you take kind of carries the energetic vibration of where it comes from. And so, you know, whether or not you believe in that, it's fine. You know, plenty of people will be like, that's bullshit, but you know, whatever, it's fine. I believe in it. But I really think that it's really important to know that, like, you're letting in all of that sort of street vibration energy, all of the potential negativity that's associated with the underground drug trade. So it's not a wholesome world. Let's put it that way. And then the other thing is that dosing is notoriously difficult for insufflation of street ketamine. So you can find yourself in a 1 hour complete out of body experience K-hole with no preparation for something that is a profound spiritual experience. And you will, like, I've seen this actually happen in person at parties. And, you know, like I remember seeing somebody come out of an experience and being like, oh, are you okay? And he's like, well, I really just wasn't prepared for what just happened. I ended up speaking to my dead father, and that was kind of a lot. And so, you know, he had a profoundly spiritual experience, but he wasn't prepared for what it brought. And so it's like, if you're going to use ketamine in a recreational context, it's just going to be really important for you to understand that you're open to a lot of like psychological shifts and spiritual changes. And so you kind of want to be in an environment that feels safe, and you really want to make sure that whoever you're with is also willing to be there for you if something goes wrong. So, you know, it's interesting. Like it feels like a lot of the world of people who are using ketamine recreationally has shifted more towards a therapeutic spiritual practice. And so, like, a lot of people are going into these communities of people where they're doing ketamine spiritually in a community, in a group setting. But it's also just really important to know that, you know, if you're going to be using street ketamine in a group setting, you still don't know if the person you're getting it from is a good source. You still don't know if what happens if somebody has a cardiac event. What if somebody has undiagnosed hypertension in that room and you have to respond and call 911? Like, you just have to be really aware that, you know, this the dosing is inconsistent and the sourcing is inconsistent. And so with that, you can end up with side effects. You can end up with people having deeper trips than they want. You can have people ending up having drugs that aren't actually ketamine. You can end up having somebody get sick. And so I really think that personally, my belief is that we need to move towards a medically and psychologically supervised model. Or if there's going to be a spiritual model for churches, that there is some sort of interaction with the healthcare system to ensure safety. And that's really the big message of all this, is like, part of what's going to either make or break this renaissance is whether or not everyone above and below ground is going to get their act together to make sure that we don't harm people in the process of shepherding this medicine, these medicines into modern medicine and modern culture. So that to me is really what it's about. It's about ensuring that people are fully educated and that there is a higher standard held for everyone in every situation.
Yeah, I think that the psychedelic renaissance can certainly be derailed by a disastrous situation, because ketamine is actually remarkably safe. I mean, it's on the World Health Organization's list of essential medications. It's used on the battlefield. It's used for for children as a anesthetic. So it is safer, but if, you know, when things go wrong, we're in a pivotal moment where if these molecules get a bad reputation, right now the media is very favorable to them, but that could shift and that could really send a lot of this underground once more, which would be such a shame.
Totally.
So I wonder if you have, based on your great experience with bringing this into your practice, if you have any specific advice for people who are wanting to step into the realm of psychedelic medicine, for people who want to be offering ketamine-assisted therapy. You've built a wonderful brand. Dr. Molly is a well-known brand in the space. I'm curious what kind of advice you might give to our listeners about building their own brands, setting up their own practice, and making their lives full of this healing.
Well, first off, for doctors, I'm definitely in this process of thinking through a model that would enable doctors to sort of just adopt the sort of protocol that I use, and teaching other doctors how to basically adopt this protocol with their practices. So that's one thing that I'm working on right now. And so if you're a doctor out there and you want to learn more about ketamine assisted therapy, feel free to contact me. I'm actually creating an online course that's all about my entire health philosophy. And one of the lectures in the course is psychedelic medicine. So the first thing I would say for everyone is education. So, there's a great website, Psychedelic Support, that offers a great network of physicians and psychologists who practice psychedelic medicine. And then there's also, they offer courses and educating doctors on how to use psychedelics clinically. And there's actually a lot of courses that are preparing doctors for the next realm of psychedelic medicine, which is MDMA and psilocybin, which are coming. So I'm actually going to be taking an online course on psilocybin and MDMA assisted therapy. And that's actually CME approved. MAPS has a ton of great resources. The Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, highly recommend donating to them. There's also just some great, you know, I personally go to the primary literature. So I have a research team, and I've got about 5 researchers now who every week they read papers for me and then present them to me. And I've got medical students working for me. I've got grad students working for me, and they basically read all these papers. And so I'm going to be compiling all of that education into part of my course. And then I'm also writing a book on the topic, but that won't be out until 2022. But there's actually some good textbooks on psychedelic medicine on Amazon. They're not cheap, but there are some really good textbooks. And so I would always just say, like, the first step to all of this is just read everything you can. And then talk to people who are doing it. So I met a doctor in San Francisco who was teaching me about ketamine assisted therapy. And he's like, Molly, sublingual ketamine is incredibly safe. Intramuscular and intravenous ketamine are also fairly safe, but they require in-person medical supervision to make sure that you get your vital signs monitored. So they're more expensive and they're definitely a deeper experiences than sublingual, but they're also just, you know, you have to go to a clinic, you have to kind of go through all of that. So I would say go to a clinic and go see it. And honestly, if you're a physician or a therapist, you should definitely experience it yourself before you just decide to start administering it. I would say everybody kind of needs to know what the experience is like to even be able to explain it to people, because ketamine is a very weird experience. But yeah, I think education, I think talking to doctors, I think shadowing doctors. And then I think, you know, just direct experience is really, really valuable. MAPS is actually really big on direct experience for their trainees. So MAPS is only currently training doctors who have clinical research sites open, but they will eventually be training doctors who are going to want to open up sites. So that'll probably be within the next couple of years. So just keep tabs on MAPS, because you'll soon be able to go through the whole training process with them. And then I really believe that if you're going to do it as a doctor or a therapist, the therapeutic relationship between a doctor and a psychotherapist is important. So like when I refer people to the psychotherapist, I'm referring them and I'm talking to the therapist about why I think that they'd be a good candidate for this kind of therapy. And the therapist is also deciding whether or not through their experience interacting with the client, if they should continue or stop the therapy. So it's really nice to just have a team around you, and you're going to be in better care if you have therapy. And I personally think that everybody should get therapy after COVID. So personally, I think every single person in the country would benefit from some therapy right now because of what we've all gone through in this last year. So I think the stigma has really been lifted around therapy in a lot of cases. But I have to say that, I think that's really the big things around it is like, and then I guess the other thing I would say is sourcing. So I have awesome clients who will tell me about the quality of the experience with different pharmacies. And so you really want to become friends with your compounding pharmacist, because your compounding pharmacist is a big player in this game. Like they're a pivotal part of this experience because they're the ones that are designing the troches. Like I had one client who had an allergic reaction to one of the flavors in the troche. And so I remember thinking, I should probably figure this out for other clients, you know? And it's just important to like know where you're getting the sourcing is just so, so important. Esketamine is a FDA approved version of ketamine that's designed for depression, but it's incredibly expensive and it's pretty hard to prescribe, but there are, you know, and you have to administer it in a clinic. And I haven't heard that it's like dramatically better than the intranasal ketamine you get from a compounding pharmacy. And I know the intranasal ketamine from a compounding pharmacy is orders of magnitude cheaper. So one of the things that I really try to keep in mind as this medicine is prescribed is it's incredibly expensive for a lot of people to do intramuscular and intravenous ketamine. And so that's why I've been focused on intranasal and in sublingual, because I think people should have something that's more affordable, frankly.
Yeah, I think that the access to these medicines is a key aspect of where this field needs to go. You know, if something that I've spoken about a lot on this podcast is my concern that if these medicines, which help us heal and help us actually excel in the world, if they're only available to the people with the most resources, then they're actually going to be making the situation more unequal rather than less. So these powerful medicines that show us about the oneness of all things can actually serve to create more inequality in the world. So things being more affordable is very important.
Yep.
What are some of the other sort of issues that you see in the psychedelic space in terms of barriers to adoption, in terms of just the issues that you see with psychedelics?
I would say that one of the big ones is the sort of matching system. So I've actually got friends working on this solution, which I'm so excited about. But my friends are building this system called Eve, and it's like a really, really, really cool system for matching therapist to client and provider to client. So getting the right fit between the doctor, patient, therapist is like, this is like a huge challenge because therapy only works if you trust the person you're working with. If you don't trust the person you're working with, then the therapy will never work because you won't believe that they're going to help you, you know? So finding a right, like finding the right relationship with your doctor and your therapist is actually really hard. So I'm really excited that my friend's company that I think David Rabin is an advisor of, it's like a really cool company that's basically figuring out how do we get these, how do we match people more effectively? What I've noticed is that a lot of therapists really want to work independently and they don't really want to work under a doctor. They want to work on their, they're used to being independent practitioners. So finding a way to like connect the doctor and the therapist so that the therapist and the doctor should kind of be able to see the chart and the client should be able to see the chart too. And this like transparency of information about the healing process, like we really do need to build like there's a bunch of platforms that are aiming to do this, including Maya, Ozmind, and my friend's platform that I was just talking about. They're all like somebody needs to build a platform that kind of faces the client, faces the therapist, and faces the doctor, and then enables all three to be able to see the process of healing and know that this patient is doing the work and that the therapist is making progress and that the doctor is making sure that they're safe physiologically and that they're the right candidate. And so that is where software comes in. And I actually think that this is going to be solved and it's going to be solved by a bunch of different companies. And it's going to be really cool to see how, like kind of to see who's going to be the market leader, but yeah, that's really important. And I would say the other thing would be is federal legislation. So we need to make sure that what has happened with marijuana, where it's been federally decriminalized as of the last week, I believe, we need to reschedule psilocybin, we need to reschedule MDMA, and we need to make sure that these are not federally illegal to prescribe, and we need to make sure that the FDA approves them. And so there's a lot of things that need to be done.
You were talking about your excitement of companies solving this particular challenge. What are some other things that you're excited about that you see coming up in the space of psychedelic medicine in the near term? What are some things that we should have our eyes out for in terms of the evolution of psychedelics?
Well, first of all, I'm a big believer in lifestyle medicine combined with psychedelic medicine. So I personally recommend that all my clients start monitoring their sleep, their stress, their blood sugar, and their movement continuously during the entire therapeutic protocol. Because if your sleep is off, if you're stressed out all the time and you're not mastering your stress response, if you're not moving your body, if you're not eating the right things, you're actually not going to fully heal. So my personal protocol involves a hell of a lot more therapeutic monitoring. And so I really believe that like there, I think if we can move medicine out of the clinic and into the person's life, that's where health, that's where healing happens. And so I'm a big, big believer in that. I'm also a big believer in supplements and using supplements to basically aid in the process of both supporting health, but also mitigating any of the side effects of these medications.
What are some great supplements, particularly in terms of ketamine assisted therapy, yeah, but also other psychedelics?
I mean, we might as well just talk about ketamine today because that's the legal one. But I would say that the big two are N-acetylcysteine, which is a great detoxification supplement, or I would say liposomal glutathione. Either of those are good. They just aid in detoxification of the medicine. And then I also really do recommend magnesium, specifically because it's just very calming for the nervous system. I'm also a big fan of L-theanine and CBD for CBD for neuroplasticity, theanine because it's just very relaxing amino acid. But yeah, I'm definitely like thinking about how to create these, you know, supplement packs to aid in these medicines for sure. Those are the big ones, I would say. I mean, almost everybody needs to be on omega-3s and vitamin D just because they're usually deficient. And so I think those are really important. So for supporting brain function and just overall health function. And, you know, those are the big ones that I like.
Molly, we're almost at the end of our time today. And I wanted to save a little bit of time at the end here to talk about the Psychedelic News Hour. And in terms of building a brand in the space, what you and Dr. David Rabin Dr. David Rabin, who's been on this podcast as well. What you've done in building that is a really great example of excellent brand building and brand building that occurs while providing a lot of really useful information to folks. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the Psychedelic News Hour, and I know that that's going to be dropping as a podcast soon. So tell us a little bit about that, how you created it and how that functions.
Well, you know, that came to be because Dave Rabin and his wife went on a road trip this summer and visited me in Illinois. And we were eating a wonderful meal that I cooked and just kind of brainstorming about how we could work together. And I said, they're like, how are you surviving out here all alone? And I was like, honestly, I would not be able to do this without this app called Clubhouse. This app Clubhouse has like been a lifesaver for me this summer because I was so isolated and I just was able to connect with people and talk to people and like show up in a room and be like, oh my God, my friends are here, you know? And there's just that, you know, the feeling of being with people that you love is so wonderful that like, I just really feel like a lot of people were missing that connection. And so I said, you know, what we could do is I could get you invites and we could start our own Clubhouse. Like we could start our own room and we could start talking about psychedelics every week. And we could start like a news hour. Like we could call it like the Psychedelic News Hour, like the PBS News Hour, you know, and basically like just talk about what's news in psychedelics. And so we could bring on special guests and we could have, you know, people who are researchers. We could have inventors, investors. We could have indigenous shamans. We could have all sorts of different types of people on, software developers, and just like get people interested in this big wave. And so essentially it's really interesting because it's steadily grown. We were very, very lucky to get some really big names. Like we got Tim Ferriss on, we got Dave Asprey. They actually republished our podcast on their platforms. And that kind of got a little bit of buzz. And then like last week we had this amazing psychologist, Joseph Barsuglia, and we had like half the room was people of color. And what I've really loved about Clubhouse is that it's not just a bunch of homogenous white rooms of people. It's actually a very diverse crowd. And so we've been able to actually garner attention from multiple, you know, from basically people from all over the world, from people with different backgrounds, different languages, different cultures. And it's so cool because, you know, we've got people at the end of every news hour are actually able to ask questions. And it's just the most perfect format for having a podcast. And, you know, I just adore Dave Rabin so much because he has taken the initiative of getting a producer to record it professionally. So like, I just have to show up every week. And like, I kind of helped with the brand design and the name and like the initial like formation of it. But Dave has actually been part of the driving force of like getting this like professional. And so I'm so grateful to him because I didn't have the bandwidth to do it, but we're doing it and it's a thing. So it's been really, really fun. I mean, every Friday, it's like the highlight of my week. And I just feel like I've learned a ton on it. There's the thing about psychedelics is that, you know, learn like education is everything when it comes to really getting involved in this space. And so I've been able to make new friends through it and just feel like I'm making something of a difference, even though it's not like I've been able to help everybody on the news hour or anything. I still have a very small practice, but I have been able to at least bring awareness. And that to me has always been a desire of mine. And in fact, a big part of what I'm going to be doing in 2021 is actually doing a lot more public-facing media. And I'm really stoked about how that is going to be a bigger part of my life.
Well, and that's a great segue to the question that is asked of every podcast guest by every podcast universally, which is, Dr. Molly, how can we follow you? Where can we find your work? How would you like our audience to connect with you more deeply after hearing all of your great advice and insight on this show?
Well, I'm active on Instagram at drmolly.co, at drmolly.co. I have a course I teach at Stanford. And so my email is mmalouf@stanford.edu. I also have I'm on LinkedIn pretty. So follow me on LinkedIn, follow me on Instagram. I'm not as active on Twitter, but if you want, follow me on Twitter at Molly Malouf, MD, MOLLY, MALOOF, MD. And then I would say try to get an invite to Clubhouse, but if not, check iTunes in January. I think we're going to be releasing our podcast then. And then keep tabs on me, because if you follow me on Instagram, you can see all the cool products and things that I recommend. I've got a bunch of great stories on Instagram that are like kind of highlight on my highlight reel. And I've got an online course that I'm trying to finish by early 2021. So stoked about that. And yeah, that's how you can get involved with my work.
Well, Dr. Molly, you do so much in this space, and you've been so generous with your time and with your knowledge. And I appreciate you so much, and I appreciate the light that you are holding. So thank you for taking the time to come on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Thank you so much, Eamon. I just really appreciate the time you had me here, and have a wonderful, wonderful winter and holiday.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.